Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
First off, thank you everybody for joining. I'm absolutely overwhelmed by the support we've received over the last few months as we've worked to build this stronger national security community in the Bay Area. Honestly, it's my personal opinion that organizations such as Defense Entrepreneurs Forum and similar organizations are key to the long-term success, not only of our national security, but our local technology community here in the Bay Area. We can thank a few commercial and government visionaries in the Cold War era for much of the success we have today. And it's important to rebuild that same forum for debate and discussion between the Beltway and the Bay Area. But for those of you that don't know much about DEF, or maybe this is your first time attending a DEF event, this organization exists to inspire, connect, and empower people by convening events, forging partnerships, and delivering tangible solutions to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. We'd love to have everyone here join us in that mission. So please visit DEF.org or reach out to learn more. As you can see already, we have a strong group in this area, and a special thanks to our happy hour breakout room host. Each of these organizations has a unique position in this community, so I hope you had a chance to bounce around and ask lots of questions. Each one brings a diverse perspective, which is always a value add, but especially in the greater national security conversation. And there has been no greater advocate for elevating that conversation than Steve Blank, which is why when I had the idea to relaunch the Bay Area branch of DEF, he was at the absolute top of my list. Trish remembers this. He was like the one that was like, there's no way we're ever going to get him to talk. So I'm super glad to have Steve here. If you're not familiar with Steve, I do encourage you to check out his website, steveblank.com. Steve is a adjunct professor at Stanford, a senior fellow for innovation at Columbia. He's been described as the father of modern entrepreneurship, credited with launching the Lean Startup Movement, the curriculums for the National Science Foundation Innovation Corps, and Hacking for Defense. He's changed how startups are built, how entrepreneurship is taught, how science is commercialized, and how companies and the government innovate. Steve is the author of The Four Steps to the Epiphany and the Startup Owner's Manual, which revolutionized how startups were built. And his May 2013 Harvard Business Review cover story redefined how large companies can innovate at speed. I'm beyond thrilled to have him here with us today. So welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Great group. Always happy to help.
Yeah, we do have a great group here. And so I am super excited to get a conversation started.
Great. Well, let's go.
All right. So. All right. First question's a doozy. I'm going to go ahead and warn you. So DIU, Defense Innovation Unit, arguably kickstarted the modern innovation ecosystem across the Department of Defense. It's been over 5 years since DIU was launched, and the overall impact of the majority of the DoD has been minimal, although definitely not negligible. What isn't working in the innovation ecosystem today and why?
Well, the good news is that might just be about to be fixed since the head of DIU is now been nominated to be the head of acquisition for the entire DOD, Mike Brown. And you know, for those of you involved in the Bay Area with both commercial and ventures, you know, the DIU was kind of chartered to do what IncuTel wasn't. And not as a diss to IncuTel, but IncuTel was designed to fund and follow-on rounds for startups who were going to eventually solve DoD problems or IC problems, actually, initially that came from the CIA and then eventually other agencies. And they basically curated problems inside CIA through something called the QUIC and then found companies they could fund. But the Defense Innovation Unit was looking for companies that it could actually solve real problems now for the DoD. You know, its first head, Raj Shah, reported to Ash Carter. This is Carter's idea. And Raj got this thing kicked off. And again, when you start anything new, all the antibodies come out of why do we need this? And gee, whose budget is this going to come out of, and et cetera. And then Mike Brown took over, and Mike never served in the DoD. He was the CEO of a large software company called Symantec, so knew how to run big, large organizations and interact with all the moving parts, and built DIU into a multifaceted organization. It includes the National Security Innovation Network. At least it was called that last week. I don't know. They changed the names weekly, which is actually the sponsor for Hacking for Defense. But more importantly, he was kind of the glue to commercial companies and DoD problems. You know, here are some real solicitations we need to solve, whether they were in the space vertical, or whether they were in cyber or autonomy or AI. That is, they organized along portfolios. And then they had a funnel of, just like a venture firm, is, you know, here are some problems we need to be solved. Come in and give us your proposals, and they would winnow them down. And the biggest breakthrough for Silicon Valley companies is that they could get you to an answer to funding in within months rather than the classic DoD years. And that was just a huge breakthrough. Now, still compared to how startups deal with customers, it still feels like forever, but they were at least the first great bridge to do that. And now, to answer your question, what's still broken is, you know, we have tons of innovation activities across the DoD, not only DIU, but every service has at least 12 accelerators and incubators, and everybody's writing OTAs and giving out SBIRs, you know. But these are booby prizes. That is, the last time I looked, we had 88 major defense acquisition programs, and they're all legacy systems. So the thing that's missing is connecting Silicon Valley companies or other innovation, non-traditional, non-primes to, like, the prize, which is a program of record. And we have just miserably failed, and the DoD has miserably failed to do that. And let me answer a question you didn't ask. Why this is important is, all of you who are now sitting in the Bay Area or Silicon Valley or work on tech inside the DoD, is that for the first time ever, all the major technologies we need to win the next fight are being driven by technologies no longer in the control of the DoD, whether it's cyber or life sciences or commercial access to space or autonomy or AI or take your list. Maybe the only thing that startups and commercial isn't pushing is hypersonics, but everything else is moving faster outside the building than inside the building. Yet our entire system is designed to acquire from our traditional folks who grew up in the 20th century knowing how to bend sheet metal and maybe slap some software on it. We're in the 21st century. Most of the stuff we need is software with maybe sheet metal kind of around it. That's a radically different set of vendors, suppliers, mindset, speed, et cetera. So to answer your question, DIU is beginning to shape the culture. Hopefully Mike Brown will begin to shape the money.
Can I ask a question really fast? Yes. Sorry. So you said the word legacy, right? And so how do we kill those, like, some of them? I mean, if we are looking at budget decreases, how do we, you know, really think about what legacy programs mean, and how do we potentially dispose of them?
Yeah, so that's going to require leadership, which we've been, and I don't mean just in the SecDev's office or the head of acquisition, but, you know, Congress has radically failed in this as well, is that, you know, in peacetime, DoD contracts are essentially, you know, jobs employment programs to, you know, as gifts to districts for congressmen and senators. And that's what you vote for. And you kind of, and because these are complex issues, you're the lobbyist for name of somebody's been in your office. And what you heard in the last 20 minutes is what you vote on. But until Congress and the DoD and start convincing each other and being honest with the American people, is that we're screwed. You know, we still talk of China as a near peer adversary. We're just lying through our teeth because there are certain places we can't win a fight. That's not a near peer. That's like we're now number two in a certain set of areas. Some of you understand. Or if you want to understand a war, I'm not even sure we could fight. If you all haven't seen it, go watch some of the videos of the drone war that Armenia and Azerbaijan just fought. And for those of you in the army, I'm not sure you wanted to be in a tank or artillery position or even have more than two people standing next to each other, and they used overhead assets that they just acquired from, you know, Israel and Turkey to fight that war. Not even clear we could not only defend against that, but whether we could even prosecute a war like that. And that's just the rate of change that's going on externally. You can't, you know, for those of you who kind of are engaged in this stuff, you realize the DOD has more demos than of advanced technology than anybody on the planet. What we don't have is deployment. And deployment, back to your question, Heather, requires kind of people putting chips in the pile that says, no, the prize here is a couple of billion bucks and we're going to pick some winners. And by the way, you know, it's not going to be the same list of vendors we have. Right. Does that answer your question or?
Yes. I'm not the one supposed to be answering the questions. I just jumped in because I just have, there's this juxtaposition now of like of old school and new school, right? And how we need, as you know, as we talked about, we need to inherently change the way we do this and speed. We talked with CNR this week about, you know, speed and the speed of all the things, and the way you make things faster is not by throwing more money and more people at these things. It's really an entirely different approach. So.
Yeah. I mean, if you just pick the Navy, I don't know if there are any Navy folks in here, the new big thing is, you know, unmanned underwater vehicles. So who got the first contracts? All the existing primes. It's, well, wait a minute. Don't we think we might want to create a new national industrial base for, you know, that in addition to the people who are already taking all the money, there are other people in the country that make boats of different sizes. And you would think we would want to kind of like, okay, let's stand up. Let's not shut down. We're always going to need carriers from hunting angles. We're going to need boomers, you know, whatever. We're going to need bombers and planes. But there are other people we need to encourage that there shouldn't only be one shipyard or one group in Palmdale making things that put wings and engines on them. We should have, you know, like a group of them again, because it requires new innovative thinking, not just the old stuff more. And as I said, or maybe I didn't say it hard enough, that usually happens when there's either a change in leadership, a crisis, or very rarely Congress gets involved like they did in the Goldwater-Nichols Act, when they slapped the DOD on the side of the head and said, you're just not organized correctly, and so we're going to do it. You know, some or all that needs to occur until you get major change. And as I said, that's painful. It's obvious to the folks in the Valley. It's still not obvious to the folks inside the Pentagon or in Congress. And I think by obvious, I mean, it's slowly dawning on folks in Congress and the Pentagon that change needs to happen. But I don't think they have a clue to what they need to put in the water at scale or in the air or whatever, but our adversaries do. And that's just not a fun place to be. So I don't want to be, downer here, but that's just kind of how I see the world right now. So, Richard, I'm sorry. What was your question?
I think Travis had a question. He's unmuted.
Yeah, I just said, first of all, Steve, thanks for being here. So I spent a lot of time working across many different R&D labs across the federal government. And one thing that was really just kind of scary to me is how much money those shops spent to vet contracts, to vet companies, to buy down what they were considering risk. Even to the point where I was at DHS, we actually calculated at one point that we were spending more money vetting seed contracts than we actually were giving out in those seed contracts. So how do we start to have a culture that doesn't even accept risk, but goes past that and actually uses risk as its own currency to buy advantage, to buy surprise, to buy time? Instead of the other way of spending so much our resources to use it as a crutch.
Yeah, and Travis, that's a great question. And in fact, you know, maybe the best way to start educating the DOD is, you know, everybody wants to reform acquisition. And, you know, I still think, you know, they've been talking about that since Washington wasn't happy with the boat he got to go across the Delaware. So we've been talking about that for 200 years. And by the way, the people talking about acquisition don't really understand the entire process is kind of tied up in the PBE, the budgeting process, and then a JCDIS, which is the requirements process. I mean, it's a two-year requirements, and then you get to acquisition. And thank you, Ellen Ward, you kind of like now took that crazy diagram and added software and mid-tier and, you know, an urgent acquisition, but still it misses the point. By the time we get to an acquisition, you know, a startup's already gotten public and gotten bought and shipped, you know, three generations of products. So that, to answer your question, I think that rather than trying to reform the existing system, we need to understand the difference between execution and innovation. So for all of you, the little history is in the 1950s, when technology was changing rapidly, the DoD did stuff that's just hard to believe. We had like five generations of fighters. They were called the Century Series of fighter planes, F-100, 104, 106, 105, et cetera. We built two generations of aircraft carriers and put them in the water. We built, you know, multiple generations of submarines. We built three generations of bombers, B-36, 47, 52. I mean, you go on and on. And what happened is, and by 1960, when the Kennedy administration came in, Robert McNamara was brought in, who was president of Ford, who rightly said, guys, this is out of control. Like, we're not thinking about life cycle. We're not thinking about cost. We're not thinking about whatever. And at that same time, the rate of technology change started to flatten. You know, that is, we've gone from pistons to jets, and now we kind of understood spacecraft. And the threat, not only was the technology curve starting to flatten, but we understood the threat. It's the Soviet Union. It's the Soviet Union, And yeah, we all try to get a leg up, you know, looking for offset strategies on each other. But it was pretty clear we're operating at the same clock speed between then. So the threat was known and the technology was kind of known. And then so therefore we spent the next 60 years worrying about .MLPF, you know, the life cycle costs and 30 years and everything has to last like that. Well, today, think about it. The technology is not known. It's changing rapidly, daily. And 30-year life cycle costs with refueling of subs and reactors and whatever, bullshit. You know, most stuff isn't going to last in the fight more than an hour. So we need to think about things that, even without the fight, need to be mostly unmanned, attritable, you know, short life cycle, whatever. Holy cow, we don't even have a system that way. Not just the requirements or the budgeting system. We don't have an acquisition thing, and we don't even have a mindset that things like that. So now let me answer your question. The best model to kind of do an A-B test to educate the DoD, because I don't know if you're all familiar with the NASA Space Launch System being built by Boeing versus the Starship being built by SpaceX, right? SpaceX kind of says, we're going to learn and discover as we go. And people think they want to fail fast. By the way, that's bullshit. No one wants to fail fast. You want to learn fast, but you will accept failure. That's a big idea. The DoD right now does not accept failure. Everything has to execute per plan, simply assuming you could predict the future. And so therefore we have an SLS that's being built, the Space Launch System that's being built, you know, at 10X or 100X the cost of Starship, while Starship will, you know, be reusable and be in space probably at the same time or earlier, but you'll get to reuse them at a fraction of the cost. And so to answer your question, the DoD needs to change its mindset about, you know, using waterfall development, which is a serial process of, you know, requirements to you know, testing, to engineering, to, okay, then I ship it 5 years later, versus incremental and iterative agile engineering of getting out of the building, understanding needs on the warfighter or customer, et cetera, you know, learning and discovering rapidly, and then shipping stuff early as possible to get feedback. That's called the lean methodology. And that's what Silicon Valley has adopted over the last couple of decades. Big idea, at least for the DoD, at least for me, I'm never advocating get rid of 30-year .MLPF for carriers or other things. I'm just suggesting there's a lot of new stuff that we ought to be using new methodologies for. Travis, does that make sense? Did I answer your question?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I think I answered about 10 more that you didn't ask.
I have a question. So as we've been like iterating on a bunch of things, there's technology problems and there's process problems, right? And I think people inside of DoD don't really differentiate between those two.
Sure. So
technology problems are sexy and process problems are not.
You know, if you think about how the DoD is organized to manage large programs, there's I'm forgetting the PO, is it not PO? Who's the head of it?
PEO.
Yeah, the PEO. You know, I mean, the PEOs got us the F-35 and had us the fourth class carriers and got us, you know, if you notice the list isn't, it got us KC-46s. Is everybody's moving the paper across, but not understanding the goal isn't to move the paper. The goal is to actually deploy stuff that works with speed and urgency. Or at least that should be the model when your adversary is moving with speed and urgency. And you're still thinking that your adversary is moving at the clock speed of the Soviet Union. So we also need a different management set of folks that, again, doesn't replace PEOs, but also operates at different speeds and urgency. And so if you think about it, if you look at the way a traditional staff organization is, you know, is organized at inside services at battalion level on up, you know, they don't call it the Napoleonic staff organization by accident. It was designed by Napoleon. You know, you had fires, you had intelligence, you had whatever, but there really is no notion of operating, you know, a different channel at speed. There's nobody in charge of innovation and learning and discovery. And I think, and in fact, Space Force and General Raymond actually took a shot at this with General Thompson. They actually have this notion of CTOs and CIO and et cetera inside the org chart, which I think, you know, when people start peering under their covers might discover, oh my gosh, these guys have actually taken a shot at trying to make a modern organization, at least on the staff function to make this happen. That's going to have to permeate its way all the way down in the DOD. And of course, those changes are wrenching. To move from the 19th century to the 21st is kind of tough. But again, and I just believe we're running out of time. You know, China understands there's a window of vulnerability. Certainly the Russians do. You know, when China moved on Hong Kong and or even the Spratly Islands, you know, we sent a nasty note. You know, what are they going to do? What are we going to send two nasty notes when they cross the Taiwan Strait? There's not much we could do. And I think they know that until we get our act back together, which we will. It's a question if we could do that in time.
Steve, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Trish. I work at Ensign now, and it is still Ensign, but I came out of the Joint IED Defeat Organization and the rapid acquisition model that we had there. Under Ash Carter, that became like the Enclosure 13, this is how you do rapid acquisition, and you can actually go and meet those warfighter needs. You can start more than one solution to a requirement and see which competes and finishes the best. But what we did was we buried this Enclosure 13 into the 5000 series, and we handed it back over to the acquisition professionals that don't really want to do things differently. Is there a way to breathe life into that enclosure and really help position acquisition professionals to move more quickly and more nimbly?
You know, of course there is, but not until leadership. So, you know, I learned a lot of this stuff from Pete Newell, who ran the Rapid Equipping Force and now runs BMMT here in Silicon Valley. And if all of you haven't connected with them, Heather on this call can point you to those resources. And of course, the most painful thing I watched was when they kind of, you know, okay, we don't need you anymore. Now we're going to make you part of TRADOC rather than make you the model for the rest of the DOD, right? Rather than we're saying, hey, this is a good model for a parallel acquisition organization. And so Trish, the short answer is, of course, there were normal human beings who did that. They weren't, you know, we didn't hire, you know, superstars or geniuses. We trained airmen and soldiers and Navy folks to kind of, okay, here's the mission, and here are the new roles you could operate on. And guess what? We could operate as fast as folks in Silicon Valley, but we need top cover to say, no, you have different authorities and you have different mission objectives and you have different whatever. It requires leadership who understands that we need to operate at 2 clock speeds. We need to operate at the current clock speed for stuff that really needs thoughtful 30-year or 20-year, you know, vision. And we need a clock speed we currently don't have, but had in specific cases. Now, I want to take what you just said and just remind everybody, some services have kind of figured this out. If you think about it, almost every service has their version of a rapid capabilities office. And every service have figured out how to hack the acquisition system with OTAs, right? And so people are kind of writing new contracts. But in fact, instead of the DOD saying, well, wait a minute, we already have built a parallel system here. We've hacked our own system and it's figured out how to rapidly institutionalize that. You know, the contracting people keep trying to slap you away and say, don't do that. Or my favorite line of even mission critical. I mean, raise your hand if you've ever heard a contracting officer say, we could go to jail for this, right? Right? Instead of saying, how do we deliver this capability to a warfighter or whatever with speed and urgency? Because, you know, I have yet to see a bus that says going to jail pull up in any DOD office or building. I mean, you know, the place where that bus ought to pull up is Congress, but, or at the, certainly at the primes and then people on K Street. But it's kind of a mantra of like, well, I don't want to find the real authorities that we've gotten to actually make stuff happen. I'm just going to follow the paperwork. Does that answer question? Or I was just kind of riffing on what you said. So the answer is, of course, we're capable of doing this. It just requires somebody with some vision that says, hey, you know what? This Cold War is going to get hot pretty soon. And we're still operating like we are the top dog. And we're still operating like we're fighting Al Qaeda, not fighting a nation that has as much or more economic strength than we do. And I got to apologize. You guys have stirred me up on my soapbox. This is a solvable problem. This group can contribute a lot to helping solve that problem because you have the experience of being inside the building and now you're getting experience outside the building and figuring out how to connect the two, I think is incredibly urgent. You know, you all have a skill set that most of Silicon Valley lacks, which is you know how the system works or at least didn't on how to deal with the government or how not to deal with the government that Silicon Valley has used to know how to do 50 years ago and has completely or mostly lost that skill set. We need to train the Valley again and how to re-engage.
So I have a question from Joe Stallings. So his question was, how long do you think it'll be before we see a software-first defense prime with traditional large primes as subcontractors? And do you think that's something that's feasible?
I think we ought to send that question to Mike Brown.
All right, I'll add it to the list.
Yeah, no, seriously, I think that's remember that's not a like intelligence test, it's a political test. It's a test of political will and a test of like, you know, where do you pick your battles and how much support you have. And, you know, it seems obvious that, you know, it should be rebellion or a new startup or somebody. Given that most, and again, there are obviously exceptions, most of the challenges we have in tech we have are software with maybe some hardware wrapped around them. So, you know, why isn't that the case? I agree. That depends on Congress and the head of acquisition, the DOD, coming up with some new mandates. Hopefully Michael get through his nomination when hopefully no one in Congress asks him that in his interviews, because if he's honest, you know, he'll piss off, you know, half his votes and going, well, Congressman, I'm going to replace the jobs in your district with like jobs in other districts.
So what I heard is that the biggest challenge is a lot of software related solutions. Is that it?
Or well, I'm sorry, maybe I was cutting out a bit. I didn't say it was exclusively software, but if you go through the list of the technologies that the DOD needs to master, the new ones, whether they're autonomy or AI or cyber, you go through that list or even biotech, they're not the traditional skill sets of the traditional primes. Was I being confusing?
No, I just wanted to see what the pain points were. And
Yeah. I mean, obviously we still need things that fly and things that, you know, go to space, et cetera. But if you think about the failures of the things that fly and, you know, and again, I don't mean to pick on Boeing, but let's pick on Boeing, the failures on KC-46 or the failures at Starliner, their commercial access to space or even the Boeing 737, it wasn't that they didn't need to, that they forgot how to put engines on wings, is that they kind of, you know, really didn't master software engineering, quality control. You know, things that in the Valley we're not perfect at, but in the complex systems, that's what we live and breathe, or I will make the case we live and breathe that. You know, and again, in Boeing's case, they were a world-class engineering company. When I grew up, they're, you know, anything that flew, you wanted to make sure it was Boeing. they turned into a financial engineering company and a lobbying company in the last decade. That's their strength. And that's not to diss those smart people who work there. Obviously, they're smart, dedicated people. The point I'm trying to make is that 21st century, the DoD needs contractors with skills that they don't traditionally have, and that are more prevalent outside of DoD and existing primes and FFRDCs and R&D labs. It doesn't mean there aren't people there who could do that. It just means there's a lot more of them outside. Does that, Benny, does that help?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. So, wow, that's crazy. So I didn't know that part about Boeing at all. I mean, I saw it with IBM minus the lobbying when I used to work there, but.
Right. So pick IBM as your favorite, whatever. I mean, IBM grew up as a hardware company, and obviously people still buy lots of servers and iron and the rest. But the world kind of moved on to, you know, a lot of software and, to, you know, a lot of people are, you know, kind of moved past them. They'll still be a big, large company for a long time, but they're no longer the dominant player they were in the 20th century. You know, even Microsoft almost went out of business. They used to own 98% of the desktop. You know, now they own almost none of it because the desktop is in the cloud and they don't own that. They're trying to get it back with Azure, and the new CEO saved them from moving from Windows as the platform to, you know, the cloud as the platform. So these shifts happen not only in the DoD, they happen in the commercial world as well. And we use a term for this called disruption. That is when there's radical shifts in technology or players, et cetera. Unless you keep up with those shifts, your skills that you used to be great at then become what are called legacy systems. They're albatrosses. So all the things we were great at in the DoD in the 20th century, or great at in those skills we honed fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, not all of them are, most of them are not applicable to fighting China in the South China Sea or fighting a land war for, you know, in Poland or the Eastern Ukraine, if we have to, or defending the Baltic states. That's not the stuff we've invested in.
It's funny that you mentioned all that because a lot of it is solved. I mean, it seems like some of the problems that you mentioned seem to be solved sort of in this space. And I even have personal experience working with it. And it's just amazing that, like, I've never really heard of this before. It's my first time seeing all this. And it's amazing to me that there's just this disconnect where it's like, it's right here, solution right here. You just got to pick it up and take it.
So Benny, the really surprising thing is, you know, how many 06s and above in the DoD could draw how Silicon Valley startups make money, or how Silicon Valley VCs make money, or better, wait a minute, or better, how many 06s and above know what GitHub or Stack Exchange or, you know, like is, let alone have used some open source code. And by the way, let's do the corollary. How many Silicon Valley startups who want to sell to the DoD can draw the requirements and acquisition process? Probably the same number, right? And so what we have is kind of a major disconnect between these two ecosystems. And I want to emphasize the point that never had it really connect before. It wasn't urgent for the DoD. It's not that they never bought from new ventures. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't life or death. And for startups, there was, why should we sell into the DoD? It's like we have a whole ton of commercial companies that we can get orders from in like months rather than years. And so connecting that plumbing, I think, is just hugely important. And all of you could be part of that solution. Literally think about helping folks in the DoD draw the diagram. First, you need to understand it. How do VCs make money again? And wait a minute, how does a startup make money? And why don't they want to spend 2 years for a SIBR that might give them $1 million when they could be making $100 million elsewhere? And why do their investors tell them stay away from the DoD? And at the same time, you know, having, again, startups understand, no, here's how to quickly get an OTA and gee, maybe you don't want to sell direct. Here are primes who are desperate to be able to add AI into their proposal, because like everybody is now asking for that, even though no one in the DoD actually knows what it is. Is, you know, somebody says we do AI, another one says we do AI with, you know, Swiss cheese, and, you know, to a requirements person it looks the same. But we could be part of that conversation. and we could help make it better and faster. And let people know, and Benny, just back to what you said, and let people know at all levels in the DoD what's possible out here. You know, there's groups like Defense Digital Service that actually, you know, is designed to do that. It's to, you know, take tech people on a short tour inside of DoD and solve some of those problems. The meta problem is, I'll go back to the beginning, until we actually start writing large programs of record to Silicon Valley, you know, or startups or scale-ups, we're really not going to get what we need. But that is part of it, is just making them appreciate each other's language and needs. Travis, you have a comment?
Madrid had a question, actually. He's had his hand raised for a bit.
Okay, great.
Sorry, Travis. Keep yours queued up. So we actually started migrating to this topic already, which I wanted to shift gears to people. Although, you know, we've been talking about technology and platforms and companies and acquisitions. So to shift gears to culture for a little bit, because we say real progress or transformation is 51% the culture. It's besides the technology, it's all about the people. So in your years of being involved, you know, in the defense innovation space, have you seen, do you think you've seen the needle move on that? Do you think we've taken like the tenets of entrepreneurship, the mission model canvas, have we brought that in? Are we getting better at entrepreneurship? And maybe if not, or even if so, you know, how do you think we can keep tackling that?
So the thing that's really exciting for me, so let me, again, not just be depressing. I mean, the great news is, we've gone from in 5 years from zero accelerators and incubators in the DoD to, I don't know, Heather, you may keep track, 7,500. I mean, you know, everything from AFWERX to Kessel Run to NavalX to, you know, whatever. And so the good news is there are lots of folks now who are kind of being exposed on multiple levels. And I think senior leadership now needs to know that the word innovation needs to be part of their lexicon. So that's the good news. I think, again, in almost all the services and combatant commands, people are now actually asking for output of innovation. Like, you know, for the Navy, let's just pick the Navy since it happened to be this week's topic for me. They're now talking about distributed swarms and distributed effects and attritable systems and whatever. They don't know how to get it, and they don't know who to get it for, and they don't even know what exactly operational concepts that those will create. But at the same time, for example, the Marine Corps is saying, well, we're hitting those islands and we have a whole new expeditionary plan, and Navy and naval forces, you better be able to support us to do that. And so we're kind of getting there. And at the same time, as I said, the incubators and accelerators, you know, I hate to be blunt, but have mostly affected culture, which is great, but have been a set of innovation activities. And what we saw with, again, I think the Air Force, at least from my view, was current leading in this, trying to actually use that to leverage new ways to build things and acquire things. You know, digital engineering to have virtual planes rather than let's just spend sheet metal. Why don't we just kind of iterate in software for a while on these things? So Michael, I think your question was, has this had any effect? I'd say yes. And it's at least having leadership ask the right questions. At the same time, by the way, Eric Schmidt, I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, used to run Google, has been just banging on the DoD from the top with these AI reports and leading the Defense Innovation Board and pushing Congress to understand these issues. So the conversation is going on. The output has not matched the conversation, but we're going to get there. My worry is that the Chinese are watching this rate of change, and eventually we will like toss out our old stuff and put new stuff that will blow your mind in the water and the air. So their calculus in Beijing is, well, we have a short period of time to kick our ass if that's what their plan is. And you know, that's a window of vulnerability that, like, I personally lose sleep over, is that if I was like doing their planning, I'd go, well, I got about, you know, 24 months or maybe 3 years to take Taiwan before the U.S. could do anything about it other than, as I said, send nasty notes or do something else, or, you know, basically build island bases right up to the edge of the Philippines. or neutralize, you know, South Korea with economic blockades or whatever. You know, all those are not in long-term American interests. Michael, did I answer your short question, which is, have these had some effect?
Yeah, absolutely. It resonates. And I hear you that like incubation programs and accelerator programs, part of what they do is not just the technological output, but it's the experience and teaching people how to be entrepreneurial, teaching them how to take their ideas and make some action out of them. And those are, you know, cultural lessons that hopefully emanate throughout. And absolutely, I think we definitely feel the top level interest, almost to the point where innovation starts to feel like a buzzword. I don't know if you feel that way, or a bit of a cliche sometimes. But it's definitely good progress. I think there's a lot of momentum. I think Duff's really excited about that momentum and helping it forward.
And I'll give you the corollary to this. I mean, it's great at building culture. You know, I built an innovation program in one part of the IC and put thousands of people through this program. And they worked on some amazing projects, worked on some amazing programs. And when they basically were able to take a couple of weeks and some of them in months and working on their programs. But guess what? When they went back to their original organization, rather than scaling these things, their mid-level managers said, well, no one changed our priority and no one gave me more budget. Now get the hell back to work. So unless you have top cover and that leadership understands that you're not only executing current mission or current, in their case, EEIs, you should have a whole, you know, parallel organization that has the ability to create new things we didn't even think about. But that organization's just is still to this day doesn't get it. And it doesn't get it at scale. And therefore they miss, you know, therefore we miss solar winds and stuff like that because we really haven't figured out how to chew gum and walk at the same time, even though they actually had a world-class innovation team going on. So people just kind of like said, you know, we don't got anybody who gets it inside. And it wasn't that the bottom or the middle didn't get it. The innovators got it. The leadership just was being beaten with a stick by the rest of the DoD that said, execute, execute, execute. So for me, by the way, somebody said, innovation is becoming a buzzword. I think it is. I tend to define it as something that does three different types of things. One is we could use innovation to replace and catch up, replace timed out tradecraft or technology or legacy equipment that needs to have more features or better connectivity, et cetera. So that's one way to think about innovation. We're going to use it on known problems, known systems, known whatever, known targets. And that next level of innovation is we take what we have and we go, well, why don't we just repurpose this thing for over here? Like, you know, putting anti-ship missiles or, you know, on harpoons back on, you know, everything that floats or arming drones or doing something different. So we're kind of using existing tech, but for new opportunities that we doesn't take 20 years to develop. And then the third type of innovation is what we do in Silicon Valley mostly, which are moonshots, disruptive innovation. Things that people, technology, problems that people haven't thought about. And again, we used to know how to do that a lot. Right now, we kind of make them 20-year programs when in fact, they should be lots of little experiments with some 20-year programs. But I think of those three different categories, you know, like making existing stuff better or killing it. Two is, you know, repurposing existing stuff or a little better stuff for existing problems or existing tech. And then three is creating things that just never existed before. Does that make sense for when you hear the word innovation? That's at least my mindset on how to kind of segment those two. The first two, by the way, can be done inside of existing organizations with existing people. The disruption stuff of creating something radically new can't be done in existing organizations because anytime you have a time or budget crunch, you'll steal those people and put them on, you know, the existing problems and budget goes away or people go away, et cetera. And the cultures are different. That crazy disruptive stuff, you know, most of them will fail, not just fail like incrementally, but most of them are just bad ideas. Well, existing organizations can't sustain that culture of like, nothing came out versus a moonshot organization that's happy if one out of 10 or 20 actually hit the moon, you know, those are game changers. Does that make sense at all? For I don't know if anybody even asked that question, but I saw it from Benny in the chat.
Yeah, I think the context of what I said there is that I do hear that word a lot, and you end up seeing, you're just maintaining a legacy stack.
So by the way, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But you need to kind of bucket which type of innovation are we talking about? And all of them are kind of valid. It's just, you know, like what people, what budget, what priority, what whatever. And here's the trick is if all you're doing is number one and two, you're not going to get ahead of our adversaries, right? It's just like large companies doing one and two while Silicon Valley are doing three. We're going to kick their ass all the time. Eventually, we'll have a lot of failures, but ultimately out of that funnel, it's not a pipeline, it's a funnel of lots of stuff going in and a couple of world-class ideas coming out. A couple of them be replacements for existing tech or existing concepts or something else. So I've been babbling a lot, Richard. Any of this relevant to this?
No, this is super relevant. So we do have a few more people that look like they're trying to ask questions. So we'll do Travis, then Trevor, and then Arthur.
Sure. Well, I think we've gone past a little bit where, Steve, one thing you mentioned was, you know, when you asked about the O6s that could dictate, you know, or even describe money flow. One of the biggest talk that I gave when I was at DHS and at ONR was almost exactly that. I would draw on the whiteboard the curve of a startup and, you know, going from angel and seed to VC and growth and on into future market, and put that up against the traditional FAR based on a time scale, you know, of an RFI and then a break and an RFP and then an award and then a contract and then performance. And it's like you have entire waves of companies that come into existence and out in between your RFI and RFP. And to your point, the money is no longer relevant to them because they've gone on. And then the other really interesting thing was to put up the exact same thing from the other side, which was how fast VCs could raise money and spend the money versus the PPV process. And, you know, you talk about requirements process and the budget process. And it's just shocking and how different those are. Now, I was in the breakout room for Second Front Systems prior to this. We talked a little bit about that, how to get those two processes tighter on time and speed and flow. And so really just great to hear you talk to that. But I actually want to defer to Trevor's comment in the chat here about third set of innovations. That's where I'm pretty passionate about as well.
If I could just straight jump in and kind of give a quick parlay. I was messaging with Sarah Seawall, the executive VP of Incutel, the other day about the Innovation Wars article she had posted in Foreign Affairs. And I happen to be a foreign area officer and also terminal leave working for basically a synthetic biology accelerator and a deep biotech accelerator in Silicon Valley. And so I'm not working on solutions for defense or solutions for the IC. What I'm more working on is biotech with a national security interest in mind, not necessarily the companies who are working on that. And that broader sense, if you're thinking about, you know, where are we behind in certain sectors, where China might be accelerating. Again, I'm going to use a synthetic biology example. Or if you look at IP, like where is China amassing IP that we do not have, or that some of our startup companies who may actually have defense applications, but who I am not actually recommending they pursue defense as a customer at the outset, simply because of everything we've talked about already. That broader conversation is what I'm most interested in. How do we continue to guide new startups coming out of entrepreneurial ecosystems that are guided by national security interests, not necessarily for defense or IC problems.
So Trevor, I'm a little confused. Is the question, what do you tell those companies?
No, I'm more interested in, like, so if we're talking about funnel of great ideas coming out, how do you continue to ensure at least some way in there that you've threaded in that funnel that is guided by national security interests, right? So.
Yeah, so inside of the DoD R&E organization, research and engineering, you know, we're at the SecDef level, it's split up between research and engineering and acquisition. One level down, they stood up a new organization in the last 4 years called the Director of R&E for Modernization, which is a fancy word for they own a set of silos of tech. And one of them they own, and let's see if I'm answering your question, is biotech to inform the DoD and services and national security apparatus about, you know, what are the things we need to be cognizant of or or be planning for, or for either for offense, defense, you know, national industrial base, et cetera. I mean, so for example, biotech, you know, what's the impact of CRISPR-Cas9 on defense and offense and, you know, diagnostics, et cetera? Or your point, synthetic biology. Is that the question you're asking? Is there somebody who's worrying about that or trying
to? No, not necessarily worrying about it, but like more importantly.
I'm still confused about the question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess my point is like, can we talk about how to increase the number of folks working in those areas compared to, say, the next video game, right?
Well, that's pretty easy, but that, I mean, pretty easy. You know, the DOD and the Congress has the authority to give all kinds of incentives to investors in areas of national interest. You know, in your space, in Indie Bio, you know, there's the National Venture Capital Association has a pretty good lobbying group that could simply say, look, we want tax breaks. And I mean, the example of Moderna, you know, getting billions to actually deliver at speed and scale, and a whole ton of venture and government, now government funded biotech companies, we could decide that we want to do that. And by the way, we could decide we want to do that not just for biotech, but a whole series of dual use technologies by just having the DOD put their thumb on the scale with Congress saying, we want tax breaks for investors. We want tax breaks for companies. We want, you know, SBIRs at scale. And I'll go back to, and we want investments like programs of record, just like we did with Moderna. I don't know how big their check we wrote them, but it was a pretty huge check for Operation Warp Speed, right? Right.
Thanks for those insights.
Yeah. So the answer, Trevor, you know, now that you're inside of Indie Bio, you could provide kind of a dual view, but get engaged in thinking about, well, what would you do to kind of like, what is it that would incent or at least direct some of the, both the investors and the startups to thinking about the government as a potential customer, or at least understand the problem sets that the government has? What would that incentive be? And the answer might be, well, there's nothing to match what the commercial market could pay off when you get a license deal with Pfizer or change here. Or it might be, gee, if it's non-dilutive funding in a pre-seed or seed round for a life science mass company, maybe that is the way to do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, and so we actually have done that. We actually did find some operating entities inside of DOD for two particular batch companies, just as an example. And I encourage them to explore through customer discovery from a defense perspective, but keep an open mind and understanding that the funding side, whether they went non-dilutive or actually did gain and get the kind of golden chalice of a program of record for their capability, I said, don't lean on that, but at least do the discovery so you understand what the defense space looks like if you were to build that customer segment app down the line.
So I would, listen, if you're serious about this, take those lessons and you should, and I'm happy to connect you offline. The new head of this group in the DOD who just got nominated is Maynard Holloway. Holiday, who was in acquisition before, he went to RAND, and now he's just been nominated to run this group in the SecDef office. And biotech is one of the lanes he owns. He'd be happy to get schooled by you. So if you have some, here's what we should do, that's the guy to talk to, or one of the guys to talk to.
Steve, I'll shoot you a note, and I appreciate that connection. Thanks.
Right. We have time for one more question. Archer, do you still
Who has the best question, Richard? Who has the best question?
I'd say that I have the best question.
All right, good. See, like all an right. entrepreneur, welcome to Silicon Valley.
Thank you. Archer Mariano, Air National Guard out in Maryland, cyber operator. So it was interesting that you mentioned one of the areas of innovation is how do you use like the things that the DoD has for new missions that didn't exist when the stuff was already acquired. And I was actually, my last active duty assignment, I was at the Air Force Joint Test Program Office, where that was kind of our mission, was to, you know, take the, I don't know, A-10 and figure out a new way to use it in another environment. The problem that I always ran into that I could never figure out a good solution to was, it was always that someone would figure out okay, this piece of equipment should be able to be used for this mission, go and figure out how to, and we could never come up with the answer, well, actually it can't. Like that was never a valid answer. And I'm just curious, how would you like change that culture of, you know, sometimes things just don't work out?
Yeah, this is what I suggested earlier, just observed earlier, is not only repurposing, is when you discover that the organization isn't amenable to repurposing, then maybe you need to move that repurposing group to a standalone organization, because in fact, it's the execution nature of the organization you're in. Remember I said that Horizon 3, that disruptive stuff needs to be outside the building in its own environment. Well, if you're getting that kind of pushback, then what you have is leadership that still wants 100% success rather than realizing you're going to do a lot of learning and discovery. And if you're not failing a lot, you're not innovating. If that culture, just by that definition, panics your leadership, then I wouldn't even try here. I would figure out how to get it out. Did that make sense or not?
No, I know it does.
And sometimes it just requires drawing that diagram for leadership on the board. Sir, you know, if we want to create something new, we can't have the same set of expectations. We need to be ambidextrous to be able to do both. And if that doesn't work with that leadership, you know, there are other organizations inside the services that provide that top cover. If you don't have that top cover for experimentation and learning and discovery, you know, new operational concepts don't come from doing the same thing over and over again. It comes from, you know, simulations and training and experimenting and running things at scale and figuring out what breaks. And execution organizations sometimes are just simply too inflexible to do that in. And so I wouldn't think that you failed. I would just think that your organization didn't understand that distinction and didn't give you the cover or the pieces necessary to do that.
I was going to say, it's interesting, you called it an execution organization.
Yeah. So for me, there are organizations that that have figured out process, procedure, doctrine, etc. And your job is to train against that, you know, doctrine, operational concepts, orders, etc. And there are other organizations, again, Silicon Valley startups, where we're not running off a manual. We're, in fact, we have a set of hypotheses on day one, but we break a lot of stuff getting to the end. We do a lot of minimum viable products. We understand that the things we think about on day one are mostly wrong, at least the startups who are using the lean methodology. When you get large and you manage hundreds of thousands and millions of people, you've traditionally beat that out of the system. And I don't mean you're not flexible in the battlefield, but I mean you have a set of tested concepts and a set of tested processes and set of authorities and, you know, how you do requirements and acquisition and planning, etc. That's different from learning and discovery. That's a big idea. That's not the same organization, even though we try to shovel them together. And what you ran into is an execution organ. Pick some other name that might actually describe it better for you. But I call this the difference between organizations that are searching versus organizations that are executing. Does that help?
I could never articulate it, but that's kind of what the Joint Test Office was set up like. It was envisioned as an innovation organization, but it was set up as an execution organization where we just executed the joint test process. Right. And the goal wasn't to actually learn something new. The goal was to just get through the joint test handbook.
Right.
That's a really good way to call it, an execution organization.
And then to realize that, wait a minute, I was beating my head against the wall, not against stupid people, but against people who didn't realize that they might have called it innovation, but it was actually designed to do something very different. And you were asking it to do something completely different. You were trying to say, no, we need to learn and discover, not just go from task to task. Those are incompatible things. They're not the same. And they require different processes, different people, different culture, and different acceptance of failure, not because we want to fail, but because we want to learn. Does that explain maybe a little what you encountered?
No, that helps a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, so I,
all right.
We are over time. I think we're very, very pointed question for you. Okay. So let's hypothetically go into the future. Mike Brown gets confirmed as the acquisition chief. Who is the person that would be the best to lead DIU as the forefront of innovation in the DoD?
I'm not. That's above my pay grade, Richard. Oh, I'm not going to touch that. I still love that line. I mean, it did me in good stead in the service, and it's doing me a good stead now. Sir, that's above my pay grade. You know, Mike was the most unlikely head of DIU, right? He had no service track record, no Pentagon experience, no whatever. But he was a rapid learner, great politician, you know, managed to not, you know, like stay out of controversy mostly and not piss off too many people and get shit done at the same time. You know, that's a great job spec. Now you guys could think about, I mean, I'm way too old to now know who's the kind of right. And I think that, you know, hopefully we could get somebody like Mike's age or younger, you know, who knows how to still has the energy to kick ass, take names, but connect these two cultures that need to rapidly connect now, even at faster with greater scale. So I don't know. I honestly don't know.
All right. Well, it was a question I got side channeled, and I thought it was perfect. So
it is a perfect one. And I teach a class at Stanford with the first head of DIU, Raj Shah. Joe Felter and I set up a new course this year called Technology, Innovation, and Modern War, which talked about these subjects, about the impact of all these new technologies on DOD. And we had, by the way, had General Raymond came in and talked about space. Admiral Selby came in and talked about ONR and attritable naval systems. And, you know, the head of the Jake, General Shanahan, came in. And so we basically marched through this stuff. And it just made me realize how important DIU and organizations like this, and having Mike in acquisition, was somebody's really astute move to realize we don't want just the status quo. I think we should all feel a little great that they're going to have someone who's a change agent, potentially, who at least understands what needs to be changed, is whether he could pull it off through Congress and through all the parochial interests of the services. That'll be interesting. So with that, I really thank you all for hanging out this late on a Thursday. I had fun. The questions are great, as always. Feel free to connect on LinkedIn. And by the way, if you haven't seen it, I have a talk on my webpage called The Secret History of Silicon Valley. If those of you who haven't seen it, it'll make you really proud. It's how the DOD and IC actually funded the Valley and started the entire innovation culture of Silicon Valley. And it's a video talk I did. There's one version I did on Google, another I did somewhere else at the Computer History Museum, I think. But for all of you, it's kind of should be fun viewing. All right. Thanks again. Hope to run into you, Steve. In person in the Valley at some point.
Everybody, thank you so much for attending. And next event, look out for the middle of June. That's the day that we can actually be in person here in California. So we're going to target that date and do something to where we can all hang out and see each other face to face.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deft.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deft.org/join. That's deft.org/join.